the concluding kings of Israel, the final kings of Yehuda, are Yehoahaz and Yehoyakim and Yehoyachin, who's also called Yechoniah, and Tzidkiyahu. Those are the four concluding kings. All of them were contemporary with the Navi Yirmiyahu, with the prophet Jeremiah, and they were the ones that presided, so to speak, over the final 23 years of the Beis HaMikdash and over the final era of the Jewish people in the land of Yehuda. The great king Yoshiyahu died in about 610 before the Common Era, and his son Yoshiyahu was killed in the war, as I mentioned to you in the lecture that we discussed regarding him, and he was the last of the great righteous kings of Yehuda. And as I have mentioned, until now there always was a pattern here. There was a righteous king, his sons were usually evil. And the sons of the evil kings were usually righteous. It was hard to put back to back good people. Yoshiyahu, who was such a righteous king, had a son called Yehoahaz. Now Yehoahaz was his oldest son, and there apparently was a great deal of intrigue as to who should succeed Yoshiyahu when he died. And what happened was that Yehoahaz was crowned to be the king after his father had been killed in the war at Megiddo. He was 23 years old when he became the king, and he felt very insecure on the throne, and justifiably so. And he only lasted 3 months, because Yehuda was a pawn between the two great empires, the empire of Egypt to the south and the empire of Babel to the north. And he took a very hard line stance against Egypt, against Mitzrayim. We see in the Tanakh that the politics of the time, so to speak, what today we would read on the op-ed page of the newspapers, enters into the Tanakh. And the Tanakh gives us a point of view from the Nevi'im who wrote the Tanakh. And the point of view, their diplomacy was that the Jewish people should not be engaged in power politics, that Judah was a small and relatively insignificant nation that had no great role to play in the Middle East, that its task was to be a holy people, its task was to be a people that preserved the Beis HaMikdash and preserved the Torah, and that it should not align itself in the great power politics struggle of the time. Also, the opinion of the Tanakh, as we see it reflected in the writings of the Nevi'im, was that the Jewish people should not engage in wars, that wars would be fruitless, and that it was better to have peace and retain one's presence in the land of Israel and retain the Beis HaMikdash as a functioning unit rather than having heroic wars, wars of conquest, wars of annexation, wars of victory, which ultimately would prove to be Pyrrhic victories, ultimately would prove to be that you won the battle but you really lost the war because of the enmity that was engendered by the defeated nation, and the defeated nation was always larger and stronger and more tenacious than the Jewish people in terms of military might. And therefore, there was no way that the Jewish people were going to be able to eliminate, let us say, Mitzrayim. Whereas Mitzrayim could easily eliminate the Jewish people. And there was no way that the Jewish people were going to eliminate Bavel. But as we will see, Bavel easily eliminated the Jewish people, at least in terms of having an independent country, of being an independent nation. And because of that, I know that it's almost an unpopular view, but the view of the Tanakh was much less heroic. We'll see later, if you'll be wise enough to purchase the tapes regarding Masada, you'll see that that was the opinion of Chazal regarding the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash. They opposed the revolution against the Romans. They were not in favor of this heroic, foolhardy gesture of trying to topple the Roman Empire. They were not afraid of mass suicide. They didn't believe in the slogan, better to die free than to live as slaves. Because not only was life precious, but the Chazal had a long view of matters, and they knew that the world changes. And no empire remains forever. No power remains forever. And therefore the Jews built in within themselves a very long-suffering type of attitude, which we saw reflected in our time in the Second World War, where Jews actually believed that they would outweigh Hitler in Eastern Europe. And that comes from a long tradition of that type of political, diplomatic Weltanschauung, that type of viewpoint of the world, of the cosmos. That our job is to survive, not to win, to survive. By surviving, we won. And it's better to survive in a subservient fashion than to die in a heroic fashion. Now that's against the grain of all of Western literature, from Homer, the Iliad, the Odyssey, through Beowulf, through Rambo. That goes against our grain. We don't like to hear that. But if any, I am convinced that a close reading of the Tanakh, and certainly of Chazal, will convince anyone that that was the Jewish viewpoint towards all of these matters. And therefore, Jehoahaz, when he became the king after the death of his father, it was not long before his empire would topple, his kingdom would fall. Because he had antagonized the great king of Egypt, Paro-Neché. Paro-Neché was the crippled Paro. Now, there were, among the pharaohs of Egypt, there were a number of dwarfs and a number of cripples who were the kings. The mummy of this Paro, Paro-Neché, you can see today in the British Museum, if you're interested to meet him. And his sarcophagus is there. The British borrowed him to put him on exhibit. And he's, you can see his deformity is, he was a dwarf with a club foot. But he was apparently in the royal house of the pharaohs, dwarfs were not uncommon. According to Chazal, the Paro, that was the pharaoh at Yetzias Mitzrayim at the time of the Exodus, was also a dwarf. And Paro-Neché mobilized his army, and he came forth to besiege Jerusalem. Now in the 3 months that he was the king, that Jehoahaz was the king, he attempted in 3 months to undo what his father had built up over decades. He attempted to undo all the good that his father did. It says in the Tanakh, Vayas hara b'enei Hashem. He did what was evil in the eyes of God. Meaning he reverted back to the idolatry. It says, Kechol asher osu avosov. Everything that his forefathers had done. His forefathers, meaning Ochoz, Menashe, Omon, that train of Zetas. He had other Zetas too. He had Chizkiyo, Yoshiyahu, righteous kings. but he picked to follow the wrong grandparents. The wrong genes were dominant in his personality. And because of that, therefore, his reign marks the slide to oblivion of the kingdom of Judah, the beginning of the end, because there will be no more righteous kings. There'll be no one else that will be like the king Yoshiyahu, who single-handedly averted the Churban in his time. From the time of Yoachaz onward, the Churban, the destruction of the temple, is inevitable. And the words of the prophet Yirmiyahu, the prophet Jeremiah, those words take on a more somber and imminent tone, because now he knows that the Churban cannot be stopped. And that the leaders who are coming, each one will be worse than the one that preceded him. And so that the doom of the country, the fate of the country is sealed. There's no way out. Now, Paro Necho, the Tanakh tells us, imposed a great tribute, a tax of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And when the king Yoachaz did not pay it, so then he besieged Jerusalem and he conquered it and he took the king into captivity, into exile, as the ransom. And Paro Necho then took his brother, Yoachaz's brother, whose name was Eliakim, and when he assumed the throne, he became Yehoiakim, and he made him the king. So you have here the older brother was deposed, taken away as a captive by the Egyptian king. His second brother, his younger brother, Yoachim, was taken and made the king. Yoachim paid the ransom. Where did he get the ransom? Off of the backs of the poor. Right? The tax collection system in the world has never changed. It has always been the middle class or the poor that pay most of the taxes proportionately. In their time, it was not only proportionately, but it was in actuality that most of the taxes were paid by the poor. And therefore he collected from the poor the 100 talents of silver and the talent of gold and delivered it to Paro Necho, hoping thereby, and he was successful in that, that Paro Necho would leave him on the throne, would allow him to serve as the king, and in effect would attempt to protect him, he hoped, from Bovel, which is the other lion looking from the north. It's like a person literally caught between two lions, and he's got one piece of meat. So if he throws the bone, the piece of meat, to one lion, the other lion is hungry for him. And here, the king of Bovel, it did not go unnoticed that 100 talents of silver could be coughed up if necessary. So the king of Bovel is going to say to himself, if he's got 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold for Mitzrayim, then he must, then he's got to have it for me as well. The price of appeasement, the price of this entire no-win situation. I mean, if you look at it in retrospect, you can't imagine how in the world they could have gotten out of the mess. The time to get out of it was 50 years earlier, 100 years earlier. They would have listened to the prophets, to Yeshaya, to Yirmiyahu at the beginning of his reign. So then they would have had a different society. But once they were embarked on this society, once they made these wars of adventure, and once they antagonized all the other powers in the Middle East, they were through. There was no turning back. There was no way to halt the game. Yehoachaz was brought in exile to Egypt, and he died there. He never returned home. And And when he went to Egypt, that was the beginning of the great Egyptian Jewish community, because we will see, as I mentioned to you, when I spoke to you about Yirmiyahu and about 10% of the Jewish population after the Churban will go to Egypt. When they came to Egypt, they found the Jewish community already. There were many Jewish exiles living in Egypt. And Egypt was a strong Jewish community for a very long time, well over a millennia, well over 1,000 years. Egypt was a strong Jewish community. So you're going to ask me, how could they allow to go back to Egypt? It says in the Torah, Lo Yoshu Mitzrayimah. I have no answer for that. The Rambam asks the question also. The Rambam says that he counts it, in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, he counts it for 3 Averis to live in Egypt. So the Rambam himself used to sign his letters, his correspondence, Anochi Moshe ben Maimon Asfardi, I, Moses, the son of Maimon from Spain, who now lives in El Fayum, which is Cairo, over b'chol yom al shlosh olavin, who every day transgresses on these 3 prohibitions in the Torah because I live in Egypt. But Egypt was the source of many, many great Jews, now and in the future. And until our time, there still is a minuscule number of Jews, still are a minuscule number of Jews that live in Egypt. But until our time, till the 1940s, there was a significant Jewish community in Egypt. It dates back to him, to Yehoahaz, when he was brought in exile into Egypt, and he died there in Egypt. With him came many other Jews. They came as his servants. They came as members of his court, they came as exiles, they came as hostages. But once they came, they stayed, and once they stayed, they prospered, and they helped build the Jewish community. Now Yehoyakim was one of the most evil of the kings that were the kings of Judah, especially descended from the house of David. The Mishnah tells us in Peah, and the Yerushalmi tells us, Yehoyakim ain lo chelek lo lamabo. Yehoyakim is out. He's one of the kings, like Ahav, like Yerovam ben Nevat. He's in that category. He's in a category that what he does is unforgivable. And Yehoyakim will reign for 11 years. And again, the Tanakh says, Vayasara b'nei Hashem k'chol asher osu avosov. He was even worse. He did things that really were abominable. Yehoyakim is the main king with whom Yirmiyahu has the contest. He's the one who burns the Megillah. He is the one who burns the Megillah Seicha that Yirmiyahu had written. He's the one who throws him in the dungeon. He's the one who has his beard pulled out. He is the one that tortures him. He is the antagonist of Yirmiyahu. And needless to say, in the Tanakh and in the Novi Yirmiyahu and in the Medrash and in the Gemara, Yehoyakim does not have a good press. There is almost nothing about him that is appealing, because we see in him a terrible arrogance, a complete disregard of the welfare of his people, until finally he is he himself will be brought low. After he became the king, he was attacked by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel. In other words, Jehoiakim was the ally of Egypt. He was the ally of Paro Nechei. He trusted that Paro Nechei would protect him. Well, Paro Nechei never moved out of Cairo. He never moved an inch. After having taken all of that enormous amount of silver and gold, so he had what he wanted, and he was not about to embark on a war. Now, that was foolish of him for his own reasons, because if he wanted to stop Babylonia, the place to stop them was in Palestine, not in Egypt. And what will happen is that Nebuchadnezzar will eventually invade Egypt, and Egypt will pay a big price for allowing the enemy to come directly to its borders without interference. But be that as it may, Paro Nechei does not come to the aid of Jehoiakim. And Nebuchadnezzar captures Jerusalem, and he captures Jehoiakim, and they make an agreement. Most Mephoshim say this was in the seventh year of his reign. And what happened was that originally Jehoiakim had said that he would be subservient to Nebuchadnezzar, to Bovel, because he saw that Bovel was strong and he saw that Egypt was not coming to his defense. So he agreed that he would now become subservient, a vassal of Nebuchadnezzar, and pay him his taxes, etc. Then, when Nebuchadnezzar withdrew, Jehoiakim changed his mind, and he mounted a rebellion that lasted 3 years. After 3 years, in the seventh year of the reign of the king Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar came back. And now the end of Jehoiakim is going to be in sight. Now, he used all sorts. He didn't bring the main Babylonian army. And the Tanakh describes that there were Chaldean tribes and tribes from Aram and tribes from Moab and tribes from Bnei Ammon. All the surrounding countries came to pick. It's like jackals picking apart a carcass. They all came to have a piece of Yerushalayim and Yehuda. And what happened is that Jehoiakim mounts a defense, but the defense is almost meaningless. He dies before the city falls. He dies of natural causes before the city falls. But the city is in terribly precarious condition, and the political situation is completely unstable, and the military situation is such that Judah cannot defend itself. Nevertheless, the Talmud tells us that during the reign of King Jehoiakim, there were many righteous people amongst the Jewish people. The Talmud in Sanhedrin says that the Rabboni Shel Olam Jehoiakim was so bad and the Churban was going to be so complete that God wanted to restore the world to Tohu Vavohu, which is its state previous to creation. In other words, it would end the world. That's the kind of Rosha he was. Except that in his generation there were so many righteous people amongst the Jewish people that God continued to go forward. A lesson that we have seen many times throughout the Tanakh. The basic lesson is that a small number of good people preserve the world, even when there's an overwhelming number of bad people. The Jewish legend that we have of 36 righteous people who preserve the world. And the fact that we see, for instance, in the Chumash, that if there would have been 10 righteous people in Sdom, then Sdom could also have been saved, even though there were millions of evil people. It's a little comfort, at least for our society as well. Because sometimes one is overawed by the amount of evil that's perpetrated in society, by the number of people who are willing to perpetrate it. But if you see one good person is enough. One good person overweighs in the balance scale a great deal of evil. Our rabbis put in the mouth of Jehoiakim terrible statements. He said, you know, the previous kings, they didn't know how to aggravate God. I know how to aggravate him. In other words, that he knows that there's a God, and he sets out maliciously to do so. He said, who needs God? We have gold, we have silver, who needs all the religion? Forget about it. The rabbis tell us a horrible thing, that that he tattooed himself on his genital organ. So there's two pshatim in the Gemara, both of which are meyerdik, because it's the blasphemy. One is that he put the name of an avodah zorah. The other is that he put the shem amforish. He put God's name. But if the Gemara tells us this, the Gemara wants to point out to us what kind of a madman we're dealing with here. This is the Jewish Caligula. Person that whose self-hatred, I mean, if you see what Chazal say about Jehoiakim, you understand a little the story of Yirmiyahu, and you also have an appreciation of what the Novi had to go through to deal with a king such as this, to meet him, to have to tell him face to face what's going to happen. And in some respects, The treatment that Yirmiyahu receives is almost mild when you think of what kind of a person you're dealing with. And this is a Jewish king descended from the house of David. Again, one should keep things in perspective. All the stories of the Tanakh are told to us to keep things in perspective. So as bad as things are by us, they're not, you know, there still are limits. Whereas there were times in the Jewish world when there were almost no limits, when evil was so evil that it's impossible to imagine how anything survived. Our rabbis tell us, the Medrash tells us, that he purposely wore garments of shatnez. I mean, we talk about a mumer lahachis, somebody that went out of his way to express his contempt for the Jewish religion, to express his contempt for Torah, to express his enmity towards God and everything that was holy. That's Jehoiakim. So he, just as in later generations, we had the. For instance, the labor union, the Bund in Poland, would have its annual banquet, Kol Nidre Night, as a statement. That's the kind of lahachis we're talking about here. We're talking about a pathological, psychopathic hatred. So he wore kelayim, he wore shatnez. According to the Medrash, he tried to have his foreskin reattached so that he wouldn't even appear to be mohul, that he would to correct the mila. He engaged in all sorts of sexual excesses. He committed incest with his mother and with his daughters-in-law. Literally, when I say the Jewish Caligula, I mean, that's exactly what he was. We're going to have a series next year on Roman history. But Caligula was the craziest of all, the most cruel of all the Roman emperors. Caligula had his horse appointed a member of the Senate. Of course, it took a few days for anybody to know the difference, but Caligula was that kind of a madman. a rabbi say that he stole women and he tortured their husbands to death in front of their eyes, and then he assaulted the women and then killed them and then confiscated the property. It was just a reign of terror. And during the reign of terror, the country disappears. Country goes under. And he had, as all tyrants of this type always have, he had a secret police, he had an intelligence force. And the secret police reported to him that the Novi Yirmiyo had written this subversive document, which is the Book of Kinos, the Book of Eicha. And in it he foretells the destruction of the temple and the end of the Davidic dynasty, the end of Judah as an independent country. So he called him in and he asked him to read it to him. He called in Yirmiyo. And Yirmiyo read to him certain phrases. And he mocked him. He said, "What are you talking about? The city won't be destroyed. I'm the king. I'm all right. There's no problem." So then he came to the posuk, "Hoyu tzoreho l'rosh." The most evil of them are their leaders, which is already less a majesty. That's talking about the king. So he said to him, the king said to Yirmiyo, "Who said that? Who says that?" So he said, "God says it. The posuk ki Hashem hogo al rov pshoeho. God has finally decided to destroy them because of the sins, the iniquities of their leaders." So what he did then is he took the book and he burned it in the fire. He took the book of Eicha and he burned it in the fire, as though that was going to be the solution. Book burning from the earliest time on is a false solution. Reb Chanina ben Trajan said regarding the Sefer Torah, "Gvilin nisrofin viosios porchos ba'avir." The parchment burns, but the letters float in air. And that can be said generally about human ideas and human morality and values in society, is that you can destroy the physical, but you can't destroy ideas. You can't just put it away. You can't will it out of existence. And you can't take the book of Eicha and burn it and expect that, you know, that's it. Because the book of Eicha, unfortunately, or I don't know how to, in an ambivalent fashion, but the book of Eicha lives on. And it has something to teach us about the Jewish condition and upon the human condition generally. The rabbis tell us that this happened on the eighth day of Kislev. And it was marked down in the book of Gilas Tainis as one of the sad days in the Jewish calendar, the eighth day of Kislev, the day when the king Yoyakim took the Megillah of Eicha and burned it in front of the eyes of the Novi Yirmiyo. When the king came I don't mean that he died of natural causes. Well, see, he didn't die of natural causes. He died in the siege. When the king of Nebuchadnezzar came against Yerushalayim, so the Jewish people went out to him, and the Lashon of the Medrash is that the Sanhedrin appealed to him to spare the city and to spare the people. So he said, "There's no problem. Send me Yoyakim. I only want him. If you'll send him out, if you'll chain him and send him to me, then I'll spare the city." So they came to Yoyakim and they told him that he has to go. He cannot hold the whole country hostage to him, right? General Noriega. So he said, people know Jewish law and they apply it very conveniently. Here, this Russia, so he said, "How can you violate the Torah? Ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. You're not allowed to save one person by sacrificing another person. You can't save yourselves by giving me away. Does it not say in the pasuk, Lo sazgir eved el adonov, you shall not give over the servant to his master. You can't give me over to Nebuchadnezzar, he'll kill me. So they told him that they're going to do it anyway, because they had precedence. The precedence was by Sheva ben Bichri, who had rebelled against David, and who was also hiding in a city, and Yoav came and he said, send me out Sheva ben Bichri, or else I'll destroy the entire city. And the people of the city sent him out to his death. There's a whole discussion in the Yerushalmi whether they were correct in so doing or not. But that's what happened. So they told him, you're no better than Sheva ben Bichri, right? We're behaving with you the way your grandfather behaved. That's what happened. That's how David did it. If that's how David did it, that's how we're going to do it also. So they tied him up in chains and they sent him to Nebuchadnezzar. But he was a person that was so used to the good life, he was so accustomed to being the king. Gemara says he was a mefunik, he was a delicate person, that he died before the king could kill him. And he died before Nebuchadnezzar even had a chance to kill him. That's what I meant. He died of natural causes. He died before Nebuchadnezzar. So what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He cut up his body. And he tied it up to donkeys. And he sent it on a tour of the country. He never came to burial, Yoyakim. It's an interesting thing. The rabbis say that exile is the worst of all punishments, because Yechoniah, the next king, will be taken into exile. The Gemara says, better the carcass of Yoyakim cut up and bleached, his bones bleached by the sun, than the exile of Yoyakim, that he has food to eat and that he still remains. The punishment of exile was seen as a more long-lasting, a more difficult punishment than even the one of death. The Talmud tells us that they found the skull of, he was never destined to come to, never destined to come to be buried. The Gemara tells us that at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, the Zeta of Rabbi Prada, the grandfather of the of Rabbi Prada, one of the Amoraim, found the skull of Yoyakim. And Yirmiyah said regarding him, Kfuras Chamor Yikover, he'll be buried like a donkey. So he wanted to bury him. He said, I mean, that man was after all one of the kings of Israel, of Judah, and he was a king, and a king is not entitled to such dishonor. Come, we'll bury it. We'll take the skull and bury it. So he took the skull, and he wrapped it in like silken cloth. So the Gemara here is hilarious, but it's not funny, it's just hilarious. And he wrapped it in silken cloth, and he put it away. He was going to come back to bury it. The grandfather, Rabbi Prada, had a second wife. His first wife died, and this was his second wife. So she saw him walking around with a skull wrapped in silk. So she asked her neighbors, what's going on here? So the neighbor said it must be the skull of his first wife. He never got over the fact that his first wife died, and she's so close to him that he's walking around with her skull wrapped up in the scarf. So the second wife took the skull with the silk coverings and put it in the furnace and burned it, cremated it. And when Rabbi Prater, when he came back, he said, we see that it's destined that he will not ever come to burial. You know, Shemayim, from heaven, they won't let him have the kapora of being buried. Some say that that was the measure for measure. He burned the book of Kinos. He burned the book of Eicha. So in life, there's nothing accidental. And therefore, what happened, happened to him too. Now, Yehoyakim had a son, Yehoyachin. Yehoyachin himself was 18 years old when he became the king, and he's only going to be the king 3 months, like Yehoahaz was the king 3 months. So you're going to have here a succession. Yehoahaz was 3 months, his brother was 11 years, then Yehoyakim's son is 3 months, and then again the last king will be 11 years. So you have 22 years and 6 months, the last kings, the last four kings. So he's also a king for 3 months. And he also, Yehoyakim, he's called Yechonya. And he also starts out very bad, but he does tshuva. But he doesn't do tshuva until he's captured and taken into captivity in Bavel. Sometimes, sometimes the hard knocks of life straighten the person out. Sometimes they destroy him completely. But he begins as an evil king. Says about him too, Vayasara b'nei Hashem k'chol asher oso aviv. He did everything bad the way his father did. Nevertheless, he was not what his father was. The Talmud tells us, the Medrash tells us that why did he only last 3 months? Because Nebuchadnezzar came back, and Nebuchadnezzar told his advisors in Bavel that Yehoyakim had rebelled against me, and Yehoyakim, I besieged the city, and Yehoyakim was surrendered to me, but he died before I was able to punish him. So they asked him, what did you do? So he said, I made his son the king. So they said to him a Babylonian proverb that a good puppy from a bad dog should be killed. How much more so a bad puppy from a bad dog? What do you mean you made him the king? He's his father's boy. He's just as evil. They're not talking about evil in terms of morality, and they're not talking about evil in terms of observance of Torah, but he's just as evil for us. He's not trustworthy. He's not going to support the principles of loyalty to Babylonia. He's not going to honor the treaty that was made. None of that. So how do you let him remain there? So he turned around and he came back with the army. He came back with the army. The Sanhedrin came out again. And they said to him, do you want to destroy us? I mean, leave us alone. What do you want? So he said, I want the king. So again, since the kings were not in great popularity, so they told him, surrender yourself to the king so that he'll spare the city of Jerusalem, he'll spare the temple, there won't be a bloodbath here. And here is an interesting thing, Yechonya Yehoyachin, here we already see the beginnings of the difference between him and his father. He accepted upon himself the fact that he had to surrender. That his life should not be, that the Jewish people should not be held forfeit for his life. And the Talmud tells us, the Talmud in Shkolim, that he took the keys to the Beis HaMikdash. It's a medrash regarding Kohanim later at the time of the Churban. But the Talmud Mishkolim tells us, the Yerushalmi, that he took the keys to the Beis HaMikdash and he went up on the roof of the Beis HaMikdash and he threw the keys towards heaven. And he said, obviously we are no longer worthy to be the trustees of the keys. I see that the awful prophecy of the Novi Yirmiyahu is going to come to pass. I see that the end is here. And therefore, since we can't have the keys, we can't have the Beis HaMikdash, I'm returning the keys to you. So some say he threw it up to heaven and they never came back, defied the law of gravity. And others say that the Kaviyochol, a divine hand, reached down and took the keys from him. But in any event, that's the end. I mean, it's the first time that the ruler of the country, the king of Judah, says that it's over. And to a certain extent, we have to give credit to Yoyachin, to Yechoniah, not only for his realism and his honesty, but that he saw it in perspective. He did not dispute the words of the Novi. He did not dispute his fate. Nebuchadnezzar treated Yechoniah Yoyachin with ambivalence. On one hand, he treated him as a king with royal honors. Our rabbis say he had him paraded into captivity, but he took him in a Lincoln Town Car. He didn't put him on the back of a pickup truck. Says Hir Kivoso b'Merkavto. He had him ride in his chariot. But on the other hand, Nebuchadnezzar is a vicious, cruel person. And his cruelty extended to all of his captives. The Medrash says that nobody ever escaped from his jails. No prisoners were ever released from his dungeons. I mean, it was Stalin. Now, when he took Yechoniah into prison, he took 10,000 Jews with him. He rounded up the leaders of the Jewish people in Yerushalayim. He took the Anshei Achoil, the men of war, the men of wealth, the men of influence, took them into exile. He took the Chorosh and the Mazger. Chorosh means the carpenter and the Mazger means the locksmith. So literally it means he took the artisans. He left a society that wouldn't have any skilled labor, so they couldn't make war against him. Our rabbis say the Chorosh and the Mazger is the euphemism for the Talmidei Chachomim. He took the Sanhedrin in exile with him. He took the Rosh Yeshiva in exile with him. He took the leaders of the Jewish people, the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, and he forced them to come with him. And they came to Bavel. They are included in the group was Mordechai. We read in the Megillah, Imagola Asher Hoglasa, Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Im Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. He came to Bavel with Yechoniah. The Novi Yecheskel was taken into exile. Now that was a hidden blessing for the Jewish people, because in those 11 years, these people established the Jewish community of Bavel. The infrastructure of the exile was established. So that when the exile came, when the hundreds of thousands would come a decade later, they came to some sort of Jewish community. They came to some sort of structure. They came to a Novi. They came to a Sanhedrin. They came to yeshivas, to Talmidei Chachomim, to synagogue. And therefore, that's why Bavel remained for all of the years such a strong bastion of Jewish life and Jewish scholarship and Torah values, because of the fact that it was begun that way. And it was begun during the time of Yechoniah. The Talmud tells us, again, the Medrash tells us how he did tshuva in Bavel. The Medrash tells us that he was taken and put in a solitary dungeon for a long period of time. And his wife was not allowed to visit him. There was no such thing as conjugal visits. And that the Jewish people were afraid that there would not be an heir to the throne. They wanted the continuity of the house of David, even if there would not be kings, that there should be descendants from the house of David. So through all sorts of political pressures, they got to the queen, to Mrs. Nebuchadnezzar. And she prevailed upon Nebuchadnezzar to allow his wife to visit him. The Medrash describes it for us in very dramatic fashion, that the room was so small that there was not room to lie down. And the Gemara says she was lowered to him, and she told him that that day she saw a spot as though she were a needle. And because of that, he refrained from living with her. So the Rabboni Shalom said because he did such a tshuva, the words of the rabbis in Vayikra is, "Birushalayim lo kiyamtem mitzvah ziva." In Jerusalem, you did not observe the laws of family purity. The ata atem makaimim, and now in the exile, in the dungeon, in Bovel, when he had nothing, all of a sudden he realized that that's all he had in life. Were the mitzvahs, were doing what God wished. The Gemara says that she was eventually purified and that the king allowed her to visit. Eventually she conceived and gave birth, and that through him was the continuity of the dynasty of the house of David. And the Gemara says that the Rabboni Shel Olam says that I therefore will forgive all of the sins of the Jewish people, and I will forgive the sins of Yechonia, of Yoyachin, because he did tshuva in Bavel. And that's really one of the remarkable qualities of the story here, is that Yehoyachin had such a, not just a complete change of heart, but Yoyachin now devoted himself completely to the upbuilding of the Jewish community in Bavel. And the upbuilding of the Jewish community as a Torah community, not just to assimilate amongst the Babylonians, not to be part of the entourage in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. And because of that, the Talmud tells us, the Mishnah tells us in Midos, that in the second Beis HaMikdash, they named one of the gates of the Beis HaMikdash Shar Yechonia, the gate of Yechonia. Because that was the gate that he left going to Bavel, to exile. But the deeper meaning is because of the fact that he was worthy of remembrance. Whereas other kings, the other evil kings of Yehuda, were never to be remembered in a positive fashion. And they don't exist. The Talmud also tells us in the story of Yechonia is really the story of the Jewish exile. That's why the rabbis dwelt upon it to such an extent. The rabbis say that when Yechonia, that the Rabboni Shalom did the Jewish people a favor, and a favor that we see in our time too, that he spread the Jewish people out throughout the world so that some Jews would always survive. So he took these 10,000 Jews from Yerushalayim early, that they would be able to come to Bavel so that they would not be destroyed in the Churban that happened in Yerushalayim. And that they would be able to build infrastructure, as I mentioned before, the Torah infrastructure of the Jewish people when the other ones came. Yechonia dies in Bavel. Yoyachin dies in Bavel. There was a tradition until the 16th or 17th centuries. It's found in the book called The Jews of Islam. There was a tradition in Bavel that they knew his grave, that the Jews knew his grave, and that they would come to his grave to pray. Because, as I mentioned, even though he began as a Rasha, he concluded as a Tzaddik. All the time he was the king, he was a Rasha. All the time that he was in the exile, he was a Tzaddik. And therefore, the Jews in Bavel had a far different opinion and a far different vantage point of him. They saw him in a different view than the Jews that saw him in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, if you look in the book of Yirmiyahu, you find almost no redeeming features, because Yirmiyahu had to deal with him when he was the king, and in that period of time, in those few months, he was as evil as his father, and he continued the terrible policies of his father, and there really was nothing good that could be said or should have been said about him. But when you see the viewpoint of Chazal in the Medrash and in the Gemara, when they discuss him, they discuss him in a much more positive tone. That's because they're seeing him from Bavel. They're seeing him from the end of his life. There are many people such as that. It depends which stage in life you catch them in. Not only true in terms of great moral issues, such as we see here, but it's also true sometimes even in terms of personality changes. Sometimes a person under certain circumstances and in certain environments can be a vicious, cruel person. If you'll take them out of that environment, you'll let time pass and circumstances change, and he can become a gentle, quieter, finer person. Life is very strange, and people are very unpredictable. And therefore, all the assessments that we see in the Tanakh are correct, and all the assessments that we see in Chazal are correct, but they are not necessarily talking about the same person at the same time and under the same circumstances. It's the same thing of people in their careers also. There are times when people are successful in one place and not successful in the other. There are times when people are important in one place and not important in another. There are times when people are, depends when you catch them. One time in his life he may have been way off the road. And then in another time of his life he became a loyal and devoted and strong and good Jew. Those are all the different problems, different things that happen in life. And Yechoniah is really that example. The sad part about Yechoniah is naturally he's the next to the last king. And he perhaps is the saddest because he realizes that the end is here. I talk to you about his successor, about Tzidkiyahu, who is the last king of Yehuda, he is not wise enough to realize that he's the last. He's a throwback to Yehoyakim. He's a throwback to the evil, to the blind perception of the past. He thinks that somehow he's going to get out of all of this. Yehoyakim, I think the most winning point about him, the most graceful point about him, is the fact that he's aware of where the situation truly lies. And perhaps that's the fact that more than anything else trained him to become a Baal Tshuva, trained him to become a person that regretted what went before, and that he reordered his entire life in exile. And in exile, he was a true king of Judah. In exile, he was the one that helped structure and strengthen the Jewish community in Bavel, and make it vibrant and alive, and provide for the preservation of the Jewish people once they did reach Bavel after the Churban.